16. In Tochoji, capital of Nokonoshima, a meeting was called by the three Delphiki spouses, Yuto, Mayumi, and Airi. Their spouses were invited. Carlotta and Andrew came at the appointed time.
You came to persuade us to leave our homes, our work, our families, and come with you to a tiny colony world so that we can be parents, after all, to the children you stole from us 11 years ago? All three of us have said no. Yet you are still here.
I believe they refuse to take no for an answer, and they are here to continue working on us.
I believe that whatever machine or magical spell allowed them to travel here instantaneously without a starship refuses to take them back. I believe that they are trapped here against their will, and so they continue to hope that our love for them will rekindle.
They must have been traveling at near light speed for a few years their time. Cincinnatus told me that my children were still young. The twins, about 9 years old. Thulium, about 8.
So they only recently came upon their means of instantaneous travel.
Are we allowed to speak?
A self-answering question.
I want to know a thing that so far my husband has refused to answer. Did you come to this world and court us and marry us and have children with us with a plan from the start to carry away our children without explanation or apology?
At least Ender left you a note that said he was sorry.
I believe that he was sorry, but still he did it. And when he wrote the note, he had not yet kidnapped Petra and Mazer. So at that point, what was he sorry for?
Sorry that taking your children would grieve you.
I'm happy that losing my children grieved me. What kind of mother would I be if I took the loss of my children, let alone my husband, without a pang?
You're right that we can't yet go home, nor has anyone explained to us why we can't. So here we are. We'll stop visiting if it's too distressing for you.
It's merely time-consuming. You talk and talk, and yet you say nothing.
We tell you everything we're allowed to tell.
Oh, yes, top-secret work, but not for any government.
Our children are extraordinarily brilliant. Like us, they all work in genetics, and they are doing genius-level work on alien genetics.
Carlotta.
Shouldn't they know what their children are doing?
I work with genetics at the top level. You know that, Carlotta. We talked constantly. I also know that you believe that you are aliens, or at least not human genetically.
I believe they are on Lusitania, where the only surviving alien species lives. Where else could they study them? And they had that hideous disease. Did our children help to neutralize that?
No. It was neutralized before we got there.
Then what is so secret about anything they're doing now?
There's another alien species.
I'm so glad Sargent isn't here.
Why?
Because now that we've been told the secret, Sargent might try to take us off planet by force.
Or kill us. It's how he thinks.
You don't know Cincinnatus.
I think you don't know Cincinnatus.
We're ready to go home. We miss our children.
Oh, do you? Maybe that's why you're being kept here, so you can have some taste of what we went through when you absconded.
Except they know where the children are and what they're doing.
The children are so stubborn and self-willed, we have no idea what they're doing, or even if anybody is taking care of them.
And besides, Airi, you do know where your twins are. They're here in Tochoji.
But not with me.
By your request?
They have been turned by their father into hateful little saboteurs.
Mischievous children.
Spiteful Tengu, like their father.
I assure you that their younger sister, Thulium, is of a completely different character. You would love her, and she longs for you.
She would be a stranger, like the twins. I knew a baby, not an 8-year-old postdoctoral scientist.
Technically, she hasn't received any formal degrees. We call this meeting to find out what, if anything, you still want to accomplish.
We were sent here. We did not ask to come.
So you don't want to accomplish anything?
I mean that we don't know the purpose for which we were sent, beyond asking your forgiveness and begging you to come with us to your children.
and you absolutely refuse to bring them home to us. They're doing work that needs to be done. I know Thulium will be in the thick of it, because she always gets into the thick of things, whether invited or not. And since my boy, Blue...
My son, Delft.
...is her devoted friend, her best friend, she is likely to take him along with her on most or all of her self-appointed projects. She would not come here, nor would Blue or Sprout. They are doing vital, top-level work. Would you call Einstein away from his thought experiments in relativity in order to babysit or be a substitute teacher of 13-year-olds?
Einstein is a name that reverberates through the ages, like Galileo, like Newton. Do you say our children are doing that kind of work?
I'm saying that they will change the future of the human race, yes. I hope for the better.
Then they should not interrupt their work.
I can't believe the twins are involved with anything serious.
Your husband could tell us if he had bothered to come.
They are spiteful, Tengu, Irie. I don't believe that they could be corralled into doing productive work, especially if they had to obey a project leader.
I think Cincinnatus brought the twins because nobody else would keep them while he was gone.
For all I know, they're building a homemade molecular disruption device so they can blow up this planet.
Most of the children could probably rig up such a device, if it were possible. But you're right. Only the twins would set a timer on it just before they left.
I wish I could disagree.
But my children, according to your account, Carlotta, are turning into people worth knowing. I think it has been too long for me to step back into their lives as a father. They've relied on Andrew here and Sergeant as father figures for too long.
Not really. Ender stays aloof most of the time, even from his own children. And Sergeant is, shall we say, the bogeyman to all of the cousins. Neither one an adequate father.
Thank you for your encouragement.
Nevertheless, when you go back, take me with you.
You would give up your position at the university?
I have no challenges ahead of me. Whatever our children are doing is bound to be more interesting than the decades of administrative folderol I see before me. And even if I can't really be a father to my children, they should know me. They should see what they sprang from and decide for themselves if Carlotta made a good choice of father for them.
You are a better man than I deserve.
I said nothing about forgiving you.
Or living with me.
Oh, that I'll certainly do. There's a reason I haven't married since you left.
No other woman can take my place?
Which is like saying that no other storm can take the place of a tornado.
No other wave can take the place of a tsunami.
I'm still not going, Andrew. As your note said, I'm sorry.
And everything that Cincinnatus says and does convinces me that living with him would be identical to going to the bathroom with Akamanto.
I'd say Blue and get it over with.
No matter what I say, he'll hear red, and I'll lose all the skin from my back.
I think you share knowledge of a story we've never heard.
What a shame you left. Everybody on Nokonoshima knows the tale of Akamanto.
And every good child fears that there are Tengu under the house. Transcript of meeting. Andrew Delfiki and Carlotta Delfiki and their spouses, Mayumi and Yuto. Also Irie, the spouse of Cincinnatus Delfiki. Source material for Demosthenes, the Delfiki orphans.
As soon as Thulium saw Jane in the lab outside Cube, she started yelling and then screaming demands at her until Jane finally came to the Cube intercom to quiet her down. Peter and Wang Mu, still in quarantine, acted as if they couldn't hear either of them.
You are not God, said Thulium.
You should be glad I'm not, said Jane.
But you act as if you had the right.
I don't know about the right, replied Jane. But I certainly have the power to stop you from doing something offensively stupid.
Offensive to whom?
To Sprout, as I've told you a dozen times already,
He'll be lost without me.
By which you mean you are lost without him.
I do not mean that.
Yet you pester me instead of attending to your work.
My work is to be down on that planet to help him deal with those damnable birds.
If you think they're damnable, then you definitely should not be there.
What will they do to him? Don't you care?
I know that he's still alive, and that he has never wished to leave.
Why didn't he come back when I did?
The philotic connection goes both ways. I think you are so entwined with him that you have the power to carry him with you. But he can sometimes feel smothered by you. So I'm not surprised that he used his own power and will to stay behind.
You think he chose to be lost and alone among a stampeding herd of insane birds?
I know he did, said Jane.
Send me there to be with him.
You would wreck everything, said Jane.
What would I wreck?
I'll be more specific. Everything Sprout has accomplished. Everything he's learned. All of his confidence in himself. And his relationship with you. Thulium had a dozen answers, but chose none of them to speak aloud.
You think you know everything?
Not at all. But I know a lot more than you do. Thulium had no answer to that, because it was true. And by now, after ranting and screaming and begging and arguing, it had finally occurred to her that if she had listened to anything Sprout told her, she would have conferred with Peter and Wang Mu and would have known she could only go to Descaladora if she had permission or an invitation. If she had stayed and met the Raven Dog, she might have earned such an invitation. Maybe Sprout understood better than she did what the most productive courses of action might be. And maybe, without her overriding all his suggestions, he might make less of a botch of things than she had.
What work do I have?
Asked Thulium quietly.
Here, without Sprout. Alone.
You're not alone. And since I'm keeping the twins quite a few light years away, you have no one pestering you either. Thulium forced herself not to say, except you. Except me, of course, said Jane. But this past hour, I do believe that it has been you pestering me.
I'll get to work, said Thulium. I'll go back to processing Peter's and Wang Mu's data.
A mature choice. While you're at it, make sure you watch the entire video and audio record of their conversations with the birds on both of their trips.
I've already...
Stop, said Jane. You haven't already. You've given them a glance and then brooded about how mistreated you are while the video kept playing out in the hollow space in front of you.
You don't know what I'm...
Everybody knows what you're thinking, said Jane, because it won't stop coming out of your mouth.
When he had looked at the woods while standing in the meadow, it seemed like a random arrangement of trunks with leaves flowing together like water above them. But now, following Royal Sun, he could see that the forest was not at all like the ocean. The tree trunks were all different, with branches coming out in different ways, with bark of many colors and textures. Insects crawled and flew among the branches of trees and undergrowth, and many flowers, some of extravagant size and coloration, grew in the dappled shade on the ground. Other plants grew in the trees with no apparent attachment to the ground. Were they parasites, or did they get their water from the air? They, too, had blooms that drew his eye. What nonsense, the idea that flowers were precious and rare. Or maybe they were. Maybe the birds were stewards of this forest, of all the beauty and life in it, and humans with their stomping feet were not appreciated here. They walked far, farther than Sprout had ever walked in his life. He was weary and out of breath, even though Royal Sun had not led him too quickly. In fact, Royal Sun was very considerate, pausing on branches and fluttering his wings when Sprout had lost sight of him, so that Sprout always knew where he needed to go next. They crossed two small streams. Sprout took off his shoes and stockings to wade across. Royal Sun mocked him only a little.
"You float like a dead boy in the river, but now you don't want to get your shoes wet."
But by now, Sprout knew that this was just a game the Kia played with him, and he took no offense. Keeping your shoes dry was a rule of hiking. Sprout had learned that from several books he had read as a child. "You are still a child," he told himself. But somehow, by learning to be quiet and stay out of the various quarrels and spats among the cousins on the Herodotus, he had trained himself to bear with patience the kinds of things that caused Blue and Boss to leave the room, and Little Mum to try to take charge and calm things down, and the twins to throw things and make dire threats, and Thulium to give her hate stare and then speak her mind in clear, deeply offensive language. That discipline, which allowed him to be nobody's enemy and enabled him to work with Thulium, had given him the strength to do exactly the right thing after Thulium left. Nothing. Just bear it all silently, and even when he spoke, ask only informational questions rather than making complaints and demands. Thulium could not have done it. Sprout's silence would have been wasted because she would outshout it with her angry speech. Even when she was justified, she sometimes damaged her own cause by making people want to reject whatever she said. But the few times he had tried to point this out to her, or to be honest, merely hint that things might go better if she acted a different way, she had shunned him for days, or sniped at him about his disloyalty. When they stopped in a place where enough sunlight came all the way through the canopy of leaves to create a dappled circle of light upon the deep green grass and moss and ferns, Sprout wanted to ask if he could lie down here and rest his legs and feet for just a few minutes. He didn't have to.
"We're here," said Royal Sun.
"Are we meeting someone?" asked Sprout.
"Someone will come, or no one will," said Royal Sun.
"Is there anything I should do to encourage them?" asked Sprout.
"You followed me here. You bore the mobbing of the Kias. Everyone knows this now. I think someone will come. If no one comes, it's because they're busy, or they're in awe of you."
"Are you Kias so terrible that others are in awe of anyone who survives your treatment?"
"We are worse than you think," said Royal Sun, "because that's in our nature, and because it's also our job. And they are in awe because they know that you chose to stay when the girl left, and because they know you could have left at any time, but you endured all."
"I don't know if I could have left," said Sprout. "Better to have that understood."
"But I know you could have," said Royal Sun. "I see how you are tied by all those threads, and who you are tied to."
"Who?" asked Sprout.
"If you don't know, then it's not mine to tell," said Royal Sun.
There was a rustling in the leaves, coming closer and closer.
"Someone comes," said Royal Sun.
Sprout refrained from saying, "Do tell." Obviously, someone was coming. But it didn't sound like a bird. Birds didn't rustle leaves except by the wind of their passing. This sounded more like someone bustling right through the leaves, like a blundering human, but high overhead. When it began crashing downward, Sprout could soon see that it was a human being. Patches of skin reflecting light, also patches of hair. But when the newcomer swung down, branch to branch, Sprout realized that this was not a human being, or at least not one of the standard design. That he was male was made obvious by his complete lack of clothing. His arms were at least twice as long as his legs, and where feet should be, He had large, grasping hands. Sprout was almost surprised that there was no prehensile tail, though only a certain group of monkeys among the primates had such a thing. The man, if man he was, dropped to the ground from a low branch. He did not walk like a gorilla or a chimpanzee. Sprout knew from the vids that those near relatives of humans did not have legs placed directly below their hips, so walking erect was hard for them. But this was a human. The hips were slender and the thighs extended directly below them. And when the man walked, he did not bend to put some of his weight on his knuckles, even though his arms brushed the taller grasses as he walked.
"The child wants a story," said the man.
His stark was heavily accented, but quite intelligible. It occurred to Sprout that he might be speaking with unusual clarity, so that the foreigner could understand him.
"His name," said Royal Sun, "is Sprout, and he can fly faster than light when the need and the power come upon him."
"Then he is a miracle," said the man.
"Sprout," said Royal Sun, "this storyteller will speak his name if he wants you to know his name."
"I am not so wise as to deserve a name," said the man, "but I saw you looking at how long my arms are. You've never seen a man like me before, have you?"
"No," said Sprout, "and I also saw that you walk erect like a man instead of stooping like a gorilla or a chimp."
"I take that as a compliment. You recognize that, despite my unusual shape, I am still a man."
"Yes," said Sprout. "Are you the only one with this shape, or are you part of a people who have all changed in this way from what humans were on Earth?"
"So, you believe in Earth?" said the man.
"My mother was born there," said Sprout, "and my grandparents too." There was a longish silence. Sprout figured the man was deciding whether to take Sprout's words at face value, so Sprout explained. "Many centuries of relativistic space travel." The man nodded sagely.
"That seemed the only way it could be possible."
"I could tell you many things that sound strange, but I will not lie to you," said Sprout.
"I think he really doesn't lie," said Royal Sun. "Shut up, playful idiot bird," said the man. "I came, but don't try my patience."
"Please don't be angry with him," said Sprout. "He's been my only friend here on the planet Nest."
"I'm not angry with him," said the man. "That's how my people talk to his people. They are much more rude to us. Because you're here, he has been shockingly respectful."
"Then I apologize for misunderstanding what was going on."
"We expect you to misunderstand," said Royal Sun.
"Am I here to tell a story?" asked the man.
"Give him a name to call you," said Royal Sun. "It makes these people anxious not to know your name."
The man looked searchingly into Sprout's eyes.
"What name are you already calling me in your mind?" he asked.
Sprout told him without hesitation. "Sometimes I think of you as Long Arms, and sometimes Straight Walker, or Branch Swinger, or Clear Talker."
"Good names for me, every one of them. But all my people have long arms and walk straight and swing on branches. I came here today because I know I have unusually clear speech, and I thought a foreigner who speaks a different, more ancient version of common would need my way of speech to be understood."
"So should I call you Clear Storyteller?"
"Call me Rokyak," said the man. "It becomes a powerful name when it's spoken in Quechua."
Sprout tried to produce the same sounds as Rukyak, but had some trouble. Rukyak did not correct him, though.
"Tell him your questions, Sprout," said Royal Sun.
I'm not sure I remember the whole list I said to you before, said Sprout.
Whatever you don't know, want to know, said Rukyak.
Then may I start with a personal question? Asked Sprout.
Ask and see if I answer.
When did your people change from the ancient norms of Homo sapiens? The arms, the shoulders that allow you to brachiate, the foot hands?
What do you think? Asked Rukyak.
I think you did not evolve such great changes here on the planet Nest. I think you have a genome that was deliberately redesigned to bring back some of the features of our tree-swinging ancestors without giving up your brains and your ability to walk and perhaps run.
I can run, said Rukyak.
Someone had great knowledge of genetics, said Sprout. You are proof of that, as I also am. Our parents and our grandfather, Sprout went on, had a genetic condition that caused them to grow slowly, but to reach very high intelligence far earlier than other human babies. It was called Anton's Key, and the cost of that was that our grandfather grew slowly, but he never stopped growing. When he died, he was a giant. In the weightlessness of space, his heart could keep him alive, but he did not want to die, having never walked on level ground again. So his children helped him get into a large colony spaceship whose colonists had all died, but their gardens were lush and full of life. It was a beautiful place. He stood by himself for the first time in centuries, and he took two steps, and he smiled at his children. Then his heart gave out and he sank to the ground and died. His body is still there in that self-contained ecosystem. It has probably been taken apart and its elements incorporated into the life of the place. It's what he wanted. But before he died, he saw his brilliant children come up with a genetic change that would preserve the intelligence and early development of Anton's Key, but remove the giantism curse. He knew that his children would not die as he did, with a body whose heart could not sustain it. I and the other cousins are proof that the genetic change our parents made in themselves passes on to the next generation. Our other parents were very bright, normal humans, but the giant's gift bred true in us. I am 9 years old, we calculate, but I do genetic science at a very advanced level. So do we all, and any other field of study we turn our minds to, we excel at. Rukyak and Royal Sun were silent.
I came to tell you stories, Rukyak finally said. But you have told me of a wonder that I cannot help but believe because of the small size of the young boy who told it to me.
I thought you might be more willing to tell me how you became as you are if I first told you how I became as I am, said Sprout.
Not only truth, said Royal Sun, but fairness.
Do you believe in fairness? Asked Rukyak.
I believe that fairness is always worth striving for, said Sprout, even though it can't always be achieved.
And why can't it always be achieved? Asked Rukyak.
Because sometimes there is no fair course of action, said Sprout. And sometimes because no one can think of a fair course, but most often because one side or the other or both have no desire for fairness. They seek only their own advantage, no matter what it costs the other, and so fairness remains out of reach for them because they are not reaching for it.
Are you quoting someone? Asked Rukyak.
Maybe, said Sprout. If I am, I don't know who.
I will make sure your words are written down then, said Rukyak, because I think many people will want to quote you.
Sprout was baffled by this. He talked this way to his mother all the time, and sometimes to Thulium. They never thought his way of saying things or the ideas he said were anything special.
Here is my story. Our ship and crew were part of a great trading clan, the Kispe. We were Andean natives, speakers of Quechua and Aymara.
though of course we all spoke Stark as well, since we needed to be understood when we traded with strangers. Our own ship and crew were of the family called Huapaya, though only a few were actually of Huapaya blood. The crew were all considered family and not mere cousins. If we did our job on the ship faithfully, then we were brothers and sisters, and we called the head of the family mother or father. The head of the whole Kispe clan was grandfather.
Rukyak seemed to want a response. I understand, said Sprout.
It happened that our mother loved birds and studied birds. She had been a scientist on Earth before she followed her husband into space. So she brought with her two populations of birds that she knew well.
Kias and ravens, said Sprout. Rukyak smiled.
Because they were the smartest birds of all. She also brought with her the frozen embryos of thousands of other species. And she named our ship the Ark, because she said, what if some alien invader destroys Earth? I will be ready for us to find another world and bring to life the plants and animals, the fish and the birds that made Earth such a lovely place. They mined asteroids and sent the metals and rare earths back toward Earth, and the clan prospered, and so did the family, even though they never came closer to Earth than the Kuiper Belt. And Mother spoke to her birds and taught many of her children to love them and care for them, so that when she died, the birds would not be abandoned.
The righteous children, said Royal Sun.
Clearly, he already knew this story, but Sprout understood that it wasn't his to tell, though his own people figured into it.
Then a race of aliens called Formix entered the solar system and attacked Earth. Heroes managed to destroy their ship and fight them off, but it was only the beginning. We saw a vast fleet forming up, and Mother and Father knew that we could not fight them off. We knew that their armaments were superior to ours, and if we went back to help in the war, we would die along with the rest of humanity. So Mother spoke to all her family in the great cargo hold and said, we call this ship the Ark, and so it is. Because as long as space is cold, the embryos of life on Earth will remain fresh and viable. Let us go off and find a world where we can form a colony, and there will be good stewards of the land and sea. We will not defile it. We will not destroy it. We will plant crops that we can eat, and we will release all the animals we can that will not threaten our own lives. We have two lifeboats. We will need one as a landing craft when we arrive, but the other we can fill with everyone who wants to stay here and fight for Earth. That, too, is a noble cause, even if it is doomed. But those who do not go into that lifeboat must promise to be obedient through all the long years of our voyage, for it will surely take several lifetimes at least to reach a viable planet.
Did anyone go into the lifeboat? Asked Sprout.
You know that they didn't, because faint hope is better than heroic despair.
But why would it take lifetimes to reach another world? Asked Sprout. Relativistic travel allows...
When the Formix invaded, humans had no spaceships capable of approaching the speed of light. There are no measurable relativistic effects at 5% of light speed. Besides, at light speed, you had better know where you're going, since there can be no observations on the way. Our ship was capable of this voyage, especially after we took possession of a habitat module from an abandoned trading post in the belt. It was already growing enough food crops to sustain 10 times our population, and it had plenty of room for us to set our birds free to soar and fly, to nest and breed.
You could not return to Earth, so you carried Earth with you, said Sprout.
We did, said Rukyak. That is how we started out. We had no plan to become geneticists. We had no plan to alter ourselves or the birds. But within the first 10 years of the flight, a certain group of people called themselves the engineers, because they were the ones who made repairs and invented new machinery on the inside and outside of the ship. They were constantly leaving the parts of the ship that rotated to create gravity and spent most of their time in weightless space, inside or out.
Sprout thought of what outside and inside meant to those who traveled instantly, but kept himself from interrupting with a useless digression.
The engineers could see how dangerous it was to have regular human shape, because we had only 2 grasping limbs, and our feet merely got caught on things. So we asked Mother, Father had died by then, we asked her if we could explore ways to modify our genes so that our children would be better suited to the labor we did. I am now what they planned then. Mother said yes, and the engineers joined with the 2 who called themselves scientists, and while they could still access communications with Earth, they learned all they could about genes and how to modify them.
So you were still in contact with Earth when the war ended, said Sprout.
Yes, we knew of the miraculous victory of Mesor Rackham. We also had enough friends in the international fleet that we knew that the public story was a lie. Mesor Rackham had figured out that all the Formic ships acted from one point of view, and which ship contained that point of view. He violated his orders and launched a missile, and it destroyed that smallest ship. And the war was over, because when the Hive Queen died, so did all her workers and soldiers.
Were you tempted to come back to Earth? Asked Sprout.
Mother gave us all a choice, said Rukyak, and all of us decided that 2 things were true. First, it was obvious that the Formics would come again to avenge their dead queen. The war was not over. Second, the mission we were already embarked on was the salvation of the human race, because until we had a viable, self-sustaining, open-air colony on a habitable planet, the human race was vulnerable to utter destruction. But if we were on 2 worlds, then if one was destroyed, the other might live on.
There are hundreds of such colonies now, said Sprout,
and it took us so long to arrive that I'm sure many of them are older than ours, said Rukyak. But no such colony missions had set out when we left. As far as we knew, we were the only one. And here is the thing that still makes us the potential salvation of the human species. We are not on any of their charts or maps. Our name is not known. Our existence is unsuspected. We did not announce our plan even to grandfather and grandmother, no one knew what happened to us. So if some enemy seeks to destroy all the human worlds and finds every one of them that is mapped, every one that is on the trade routes, they will not find us.
Except now my people know you're here, said Sprout.
But you haven't told anyone else, said Rukyak.
We have not, said Sprout.
Because you also haven't told the other worlds about your instantaneous travel, said Rukyak.
We have not, though on several worlds there are people who have enough evidence to guess, said Sprout.
A guess is not knowledge, and a rumor of such a miracle will not be believed.
We're counting on that, said Sprout.
The children of the engineers were born to look like us. The plan was a good one. With specially designed spacesuits, they could work outside the ship with far greater safety, for they could hold on tightly with one hand, glove locked in place, while three other hands could do the work. Inside the ship, normal children would gather to watch that first generation of long-armed, four-handed engineers as they brachiated easily throughout the ship, regardless of whether this or that part was weightless or had some kind of centrifugal gravity. The Runa, the folk, the normal people, they had to watch their children to try to keep them from imitating us, because they could get injured or die imitating the way we lived and worked.
So you call your people engineers? Asked Sprout.
We call ourselves the Yachachi Runa, and each of us is a Yachachi. We hardly use Quechua anymore, except in holy ceremonies, but in those days it was simply the Quechua word for engineer or technician, and now it is our name.
And you live here among the trees?
During spring, summer, and autumn, said Rukyak. In winter, we go underground with the Runa. It can be bitterly cold up here. Ice and snow make the branches slippery, and we would rather live underground for part of each year than try to live our lives with clothing. There is no clothing that gives us the freedom of movement that we need.
Thank you for answering my question, said Sprout.
I was glad to tell you. It is the short version, of course. There are hundreds of stories on the same theme, dealing with particular events during the journey and when we first arrived at the nest. Someday you may hear those stories.
Have you written them down? Asked Sprout.
Writing is not telling, said Rukyak. I'm sure that down below they have written everything true and everything else as well. What is that to us? Only through the ears can a story be well told and be well heard.
Sprout wasn't sure this was true, considering that most of his knowledge of everything outside his own family's dynamics had come from reading. But then, maybe it was true, and he was woefully undereducated.
Was that your only question? Asked Rukyak. I think not, because you had questions before you ever knew that people like the Yachachi Runa even existed.
In telling me the story of the Yachachi Runa, said Sprout, you also answered my questions about the Ark and the reason why no one knew of this colony world. But I am just as interested in the story of how ravens and kias acquired human speech and human knowledge. In the science I was taught, corvids and parrots are the most intelligent of birds, but their intelligence is rated as being somewhere between that of horses and of dogs. Royal's son gave a squawk.
Shut up, parrot, said Rukyak.
I don't even know what that would mean, said Sprout. I've never seen a horse or a dog, except in vids, but the brains of birds are nowhere near the size of mammal brains, and certainly not primate brains. How can they contain so much knowledge?
While Royal Sun preens and otherwise shows his resentment, I will tell you. We did not modify the genomes of the birds. During the voyage, the birds bred intelligence into themselves. They have many more generations per century than humans have, and the ravens began determining which birds should pair up and breed. Ruthlessly, they killed those that they determined should not breed at all. By the time we arrived at the nest, all the living ravens understood human speech. As we formed our colony, the ravens scouted for us and reported to us about the flora and fauna of this world.
Sprout vaguely remembered that there was something about a raven in the story of Noah and his ark, but he kept that thought to himself, because this story was apparently true.
The ravens continue to breed themselves into ever greater intelligence, said Rukyak. The Kias saw how closely the ravens communicated with the humans and the great advantages they gained, and so the Kias began, in their playful way, to encourage the most intelligent birds to mate. But they don't kill anybody. Stupid Kias are just as useful to the flock as smart ones. I think you'll understand, Sprout, that the ability to aim poop at a target and to choose whether to include uric acid with the poop can be learned and strengthened with practice, without requiring deep intellect. They all seem to have excellent aim. The Kias don't let really smart ones like Royal Sun rule over them. But when there's a game afoot, they'll join in and follow the rules that the smart one lays out for them. And remember, even stupid Kias are really, really smart.
Only one really was needed, said Royal Sun.
So humans did not create the talking ravens or the talking Kias, but we recognized that they were people just as the Yachachiruna and the folk are people. We agreed to share this world. After 2 centuries in a spaceship, even with the habitat, the folk were uncomfortable in open air, under the sky, but the ravens and Kias loved it. They belonged here on the surface. So did the Yachachiruna during warm seasons. So we too make nests in the forest canopy and raise our children in the sky. But we build no buildings. That's for the miners, the ones who burrow deep into the stone.
Where do you grow your food? Asked Sprout. We couldn't see any evidence of agriculture, at least not from space.
You walked through the meadows, didn't you? Asked Rukyak. What kinds of grasses do you think those are? No one mows them except at harvest time. In swamps, we grow rice, and the rice reseeds itself. The wheat and maize do the same. And though the rodents eat many of the seeds, there are few mets fertilize the ground. We encourage beans to grow between harvests to replenish the nitrogen in the soil. The whole world is a vast farm, which we harvest at need. So you saw our farms from space. It looked like nature to you.
Those are all the questions I feel I should ask, and you have answered them beyond my best hopes.
I told true stories.
As did I.
Yet here we are, and you choose to end our conversation?
The other questions I have are scientific, genetic specifically. Here on the surface, do you Yachachiruna study genetics?
We study everything that the folk study. During winter, we use all their machines and design new ones for them. We're still the best engineers, and we go down and solve problems for them all year. So when it's time for you to study our genes and the genes of the birds and our stingless bees, it is as likely to be a Yachachi who works with you as not. But I know the real barrier. The first message we sent you was of a huge and peculiar gene, a virus of sorts. That was because we thought you might be the people who sent it to us. So we sent our version back to you to say, are you the people who made this? And your answers are still inscrutable.
As are your messages, said Sprout. In the box up there, some of them think you created that virus. On our world, it caused horrible devastation and destroyed the biota of a planet. So, if you sent it, then you must be an enemy.
We met that virus when we got here, but it didn't come on us as a disease, and it destroyed nothing. We found a complex, though primitive, biosphere on Nest, and we have worked carefully to try to avoid extinguishing any of the native species. But that virus didn't kill anything.
What do you call it? Asked Sprout.
The recorder, said Rukyak.
Sprout was baffled.
Why?
Rukyak looked at him as if he were crazy.
Because that's what it does. It records.
Records what? Asked Sprout.
Genomes, said Rukyak. What did you think it did?
Sprout sat there in silence, thinking, trying to make sense of how they could think of the Descolada as such a harmless thing when it had seemed like the end of the human species if it once got free from Lusitania. I think, said Sprout, that it's time for me to...
Go home,
said Royal Sun.
Report to your people, said Rukyak. But I tell you first, you are always welcome here, Sprout. You are invited.
By the Kias as well? Asked Sprout. Royal Sun made a couple of trilling sounds.
We regard you as our friend.
As soon as he said that, several Kias flew into the clearing and dropped pieces of Sprout's stolen gear at his feet, but they brought none of Thulium's things. Sprout said, Thank you, my friends. He gathered up the gear and stuffed it into his pockets as best he could. It certainly wasn't everything he had brought, but it included the most expensive things. I hope I'll be able to come back. This has been an amazing day, but your kindness has been...
Flattery, flattery, said Rukyak. Yes, we're amazing. You're amazing. Now, let's not be like people who can't leave the party because they stand at the door saying goodbye forever. It's time for you to go. So, go.
Rukyak looked at him as if he expected Sprout to simply disappear. And Sprout thought of Kyubey and how much he wanted to go there and tell everybody what he had learned. Just like that, Rukyak wasn't there. Royal Sun was gone. The trees were gone. Sprout stood in Kyubey, with daylight streaming through the windows of the lab. Nobody was working in the lab. Hadn't they left anyone to watch for him? Oh, right. They didn't know that Sprout had somehow learned to transport himself. Or else maybe Jane simply read his mind and knew he wanted to come home and she transported him. At the moment, he didn't care which, because he hadn't aspired to the power anyway. So maybe Jane knew he was back and maybe she didn't. Sprout looked for the phone, found it, and dialed the number of the mess hall.
We're not serving until 5:30, said the head cook. This is Sprout, Brussels Delphiki. I don't think anybody knows I'm back, but I'm in the quarantine bay. Would you let somebody know I'm here? Oh, so I have to cook dinner and run errands for lazy children? You know I can't leave Q-Bay, and there's nobody else here. I wouldn't call you if I had any other choice. You mean this is the only phone number that you know? I never need to call anybody else because they're always in my face. She laughed. I'll run your errand, space boy. She hung up before Sprout could thank her. He lay down on an examining table and relaxed, hoping to catch a few winks before the tests and debriefing began.